I am Maggie Dominic, and this is the oral history of Hector Ubari. It is April 8th, 2019, and we are at the Actors Fund in New York City.
So, Hector, can you tell me, what do you think that people will remember you for now?
At this moment, it'll be Rico in Crocodile Dundee 2. It's well known, the film is very popular, still is. It's still playing on television. And I'm still making money from it after all these years. We shot it in 1987.
That's amazing. How did you get the part?
Well, I got the part when I was at the health club. Mm-hmm. And I was running on the machine, and I said, you know, we didn't have cell phones then in 87. So I had to go upstairs and check my answering machine. And there was a message from my agent and said, they want to see you today, the same day, for a sequel to Crocodile Dundee. So I said, okay. I hadn't seen the film. She said, well, let me read you the description. And it said he's got gold chains around his neck. And he has death in his eyes. And I said to Lynn, I said, okay. She said, you can either pick up the sides, which are the scenes to audition now, and then, or you can just show up later and do it. And I said, you know, I'm a perfectionist. And I decided, I don't want to embarrass myself. Let me at least go and pick it up and then come back. And I did that. And I read through it, and it said all these terrible things about this character. And I said, and I looked at myself in the mirror, and I said, I always have to look at myself in the mirror and say, that's not me. I don't look like that. I'm too innocent looking, which has always been a problem for me anyway. But then I said, well, okay. I said, they're never going to see me as this character. They're not going to give me this job. So let me have fun. And I'm gonna show off. I'm going to show off and show them what they could have gotten if they had been smart and not gone with the cliché. So I went through my closet, and I went through different clothes changes, and I said, "Ah, that's it. I'm going to make him a playboy." Mm-hmm. I said, "What the hell? They're not going to cast me anyway, so I might as well just do what I want to do."
Right.
And so I put on a black shirt, a little a necklace with a little H on it, which is my name, Hector, and nice pants, and I said, that's it. That's it. I looked at the scenes. There were like three monologues. One of them, I compare myself to Michael Jackson.
Huh.
I said, you look, I tell the girl, you see down there? There's a zoo there. He says, like Michael Jackson. And I said, I make more money than Michael Jackson.
That was when you were...
That was in the lines.
Oh,
and
wow.
I tried to do that stuff, and I figured, what the heck? As I'm showing off anyway, and it's a fantasy, because I'm never going to get this role. I can just do what I want, and I did. When I went to the audition, I saw other actors with... some had gold teeth to make it look really menacing. And some put scars on their faces, fake scars. And I looked around and I said, well, okay, one of them will get it. I'm not going to worry about it because I'm going to have fun.
Okay.
And so I went in there and I did exactly what I wanted to do. I was showing off. It was like I was going on the town, like I was going on a date as a playboy. And I read and read, and she wanted to know where I was from. She says, where are you from, really? And I knew that I'm Puerto Rican and the character's a Colombian.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, you know, my parents, they lost my passport many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was not going to give her the privilege to hang myself by saying I was Puerto Rican.
Oh, wow.
And knowing that the character's Colombian. So I said, you know, I'm from many different places.
That's good.
So I kept her at bay and never really giving her an answer as to where I was really from. And so I said, okay, I started to give her the papers after I finished reading. She said, no, hold on to them, the scenes.
Right.
So then I had a good feeling about it, so I called my agent when I got home, and I said, you know, we might hear from them. You never know.
Right.
A week later, we did hear from them. And they said, they want you to do everything you did the same way. So next week, then I started having my doubts. I said, oh, wait a minute. Am I ever going to really pull this off? Mm. And so then I started looking at movies. One of them was This Gun for Hire, which was Alan Ladd. Now, Alan Ladd had a problem, too, because he was a very good-looking man, very soft in his face, and he wasn't mean-looking. And they didn't want to give him the job as Raven, the killer. That's why it's called This Gun for Hire. He was a killer.
Mm-hmm.
And his agent said, no, you got to see him. Give him a chance. And he got the role, and of course, it's now famous.
Mm-hmm.
But I looked at that film just to convince myself that I could be bad and still, you know, get the job. So the next audition comes in. I didn't realize, but the producer was there, who was also the director, John Cornell. And John, I auditioned again. I did my lines. And he kept saying, when is Paul going to get here? Paul Hogan.
Mm-hmm.
He said, he's got to see him. And Paul Hogan never saw me. But the next thing I know, they start taking my measurements, clothes. And then he says, would you like to go to Australia? And of course, I kept acting like, not really that interested.
Oh, wow.
Because I wanted to... this character that I had created, which was, I don't care.
Right.
So I said, well, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
I was not going to let go of the persona that I had created.
Yeah.
And so they said, well, I think you're going to go to Australia, said to me. I said, call my agent. I was not going to be excited and get and fall off the character, and then so they could see the real Hector. You know, I was putting on some airs as to being really bon vivant,
mm-hmm.
really top of the world type of character. And so then and they said, well, and then a week later or 10 days later, we were flying to Australia.
How was that?
It was very strange.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was very strange because, I mean, you know, I was a kid from Harlem originally. So I knew some tough guys. I had my grandfather, one of my grandfathers, I say one of them, he was known as Machete. Machete is, in English, is machete, you know,
mm-hmm.
the knife. And he got that name for some reason. I mean, it wasn't like... So I figured, well, I think it's part of my bloodline that I could be tough. I mean, but I had to convince myself. So we get to Australia, and we do what they call post-production, I guess, where they actually try clothes on you. They told me to bring a hat. They said, the sun is a killer in the bush. So bring a hat with you. And I bought a hat when I was doing a Man of La Mancha in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
One of those, what do you call those, old shops where you can buy clothes, old vintage clothing.
Oh, like a secondhand store.
Yeah,
kind of.
And there was a hat there.
Vintage.
There was a hat, a fedora,
uh-huh.
One of those Panama hats.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought it for $5.
Nice.
So I took that with me. And... they tried different hats on me,
mm-hmm.
because they figured this character has to have different hats, and they all look so big for my face because I'm a small frame.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally, I said, you know, I brought a hat.
Uh-huh.
And I said, you did? I said, yes. And I put it on. And they looked at it and they said, that's the one. That's the hat you're going to wear. So then I gave them the hat and they made extra copies of it.
Yeah.
So that they can keep it, you know, in case mm-hmm. one breaks, the other one. So I never got credit for that, by the way.
But that was you.
That was me. And I changed the name of the character. Mm-hmm. The name of the character originally was Rica, R-I-C-C-A. Mm-hmm. And then I thought it was a little bit effeminate. I said, you know, what about Rico?
Right. Huh.
At this point, they gave me carte blanche. They said, whatever you want. Of course, I kept playing up the character that I was playing with. I wasn't going to let them see the scared Hector.
Right.
You know, the real person, because then they might have said, go home. So I figured, you know, let me just keep playing this up, this kind of playboy image. And also in the script that they gave me, it said, there's a scene, a night scene that we shot, and it said something about, well, it's good that the Phantom is here. The Phantom. I said, wait a minute, I know the Phantom. It's a cartoon character in newspapers. A guy that wears a mask and a one-piece outfit. Mm. And he goes on a horse. And I said, you know, Americans don't really know that much about the Phantom. I said, now, if I were to say something like, well, it's a good thing I brought the kryptonite. I said, Superman, everybody knows kryptonite. Mm-hmm. They wrote that into the script. I never got credit for it.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, it was a great experience. We were there for, we went after Sydney, Australia, we did the post-production, or the pre-production, costumes and so on, you had to do a medical, take your blood count and make sure you don't have, because they don't want you to collapse. They're paying you all this money. They want to make sure you stay healthy. So we flew over to Darwin. Mm-hmm. Darwin is in what is called the Northern Territory. From Sydney, it's like 4 hours by plane. And then we had to take jeeps, 3 hours ride into the actual bush. They allowed us to shoot in sacred lands, sacred Aboriginal lands, which was a privilege because no one was just given the opportunity to do that. we got there. I had my own house. It was like an old silver mining area, and they had 6 houses. Paul Hogan got his house. Linda Kaslasi got her house. I shared with two of my bodyguards in the film. You know, they're part of the film. And the director got his film. And then the crew, all of the crew came in with vans so that they could sleep and so on. And we did a wonderful month shoot in the bush. No police, no traffic lights, no civilization. But we had snakes. You know, Australia's famous for 16 of the world's poisonous snakes are in Australia. They had alligators. They had someone come in and talk to us about alligators. Actual crocodiles. We shot in the dry season. There are 2 seasons in the Northern Territory, the wet and the dry. I guess we shot in the dry because had it been the wet, the crocodiles would have gone everywhere. So we shot in the dry season. They had what they call a crocodile handler come in and talk to us about the do's and don'ts while you're on the camp. You know, although it was fenced, they can get through. They have dingo, wild dogs.
Did you see any wildlife?
I saw quite a bit of wildlife. When we shot, they had a guy on a boat, a little boat, rowboat type of thing with rifles, in case a crocodile came too close, they would shoot them. It's a little scary, nerve-wracking.
I'm sure.
And but once we left, a month later, mm-hmm. from the bush, you know, it's like Stockholm Syndrome. You feel safe in what mm-hmm. in this environment, and all of a sudden you come back to civilization, and you go, wait a minute, why am I here? It's a very strange experience.
Mm-hmm.
After you've been a month there in the bush, to come out to where there are people around, and you go, well, send me back to the bush. If that's what you're used to.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, then we flew from there to Byron Bay, and we shot some other scenes there,
mm-hmm.
which are the scenes that take place in South America.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than flying the whole crew to South America, we shot in the mountains of Byron Bay, and we shot the South American scene. Unfortunately, some of those scenes were cut out.
Why?
Oh, they created a whole village, a South American village.
Oh, wow.
To look like Colombia.
Yeah.
They hired extras. They had mules. They had peasants all over the place. They just took it out.
Hmm.
We saw them in the daily rushes, the scenes that were shot.
Yeah.
But I guess for time restraint,
mm.
they cut those scenes. That was unfortunate,
because
mm-hmm. all those actors work so hard to do those scenes, and they were cut out. So then we went back to Sydney, and then on the way, and then we had to go to New York and start shooting the New York scenes
mm.
of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So in total, I got like 19 weeks of work.
That's nice.
And the rest is history, because what it did for me, it put me in the history books of film.
Mm-hmm.
Because wherever you look, in books and everything, there's my name.
Yeah.
And it's a very popular film even now.
Mm-hmm.
It was done in 87, and we're 2019, and still it's on television.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I still get paid for it.
Perfect. Amazing.
It's a lifelong thrill
mm-hmm.
to be associated with this kind of a film.
Right. And new generations keep seeing this film and keep, yeah.
And they keep writing me.
That's wonderful.
I keep getting letters.
Because
people probably think I look the same as I did in 87, but still, you know, now that I do cabaret shows and stuff like that, I always put on my emails or blogs that look what became of Rico. He's now a cabaret performer, and that was that film.
Mm-hmm.
So I will always be forever. I wouldn't use the word grateful, because I had to do a lot to get that job.
Definitely.
But it was the best experience I've ever had in film.
Mm-hmm.
I've done other films. I've done films in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
One in particular was a French-German production. So what happens is you speak in English. I spoke in English. And every other actor that they hired spoke in their native language. Somebody spoke in French, somebody spoke in German. And I had to, in order to know when to say my lines, I told this actress who was speaking in German, I said, you know, I put a knife to her throat. That was my character. It was called Mario. And Mario was a hired killer for this French entrepreneur, and we shot in Prague, and at one point I said to the actress, just let me know the last lines you say in German,
mm-hmm.
so that I'll know when to come in. And that was an interesting experience. I was there when it was still communist. It was Czechoslovakia then. It was called Czechoslovakia, and it was still communist, and when I got there, the director says, I got there on a Monday morning, and on Friday, when I met the director, he says, on Friday we leave for Vienna, because the revolution begins. Typical Americans, you know. I said, oh, really? Come on.
Oh, my gosh.
So we went to Vienna for that weekend, and in the news, all the tanks had come in, and everybody was, they were throwing bombs and everything. I said, oh, my God, it did happen. The revolution did begin. So we had to come back because we had to finish shooting. I had my video camera with me. I didn't dare take it out because, you know, you're in a communist country, you don't do that.
Yeah.
But once the international press with cameras and videos came in and they started shooting, I said, well, I guess I can shoot the revolution too. And I still have it at home, my video of the revolution that overthrew the Communist Party in Czechoslovakia. That was an interesting experience. Another film I did in Europe, another German film, was in German it's called Brennen den Herz. In English it would be translated like the Ardent Heart.
Mm.
It's a true story.
Oh.
It's a true story, and rather than, I played a Mexican general, mm-hmm. General Ruiz. And I was in love with this woman who happened to be Dominique Sanda, the famous French movie actress. Mm. And I even got to do the Mexican hat dance with her. I shot in German first, in Germany, and then I came home, and then I flew back 10 days later to Mallorca, Spain.
Wow.
It is the most, you know, being an actor has its rewards, traveling to all these wonderful places. I had a scene with Helmut Greem. Helmut Greem was the lead in this movie, a German actor. And as a matter of fact, he's known because, remember that movie Cabaret,
mm-hmm.
with Joel Grey and Liza Minnelli? Well, he gets third billing.
Huh.
He was one of the stars of that movie. Helmut Greem. But in this particular scene we did in that movie, I spoke in Spanish, and he spoke in Spanish. It was supposed to be in Mexico. But he spoke with, phonetically, he did very well.
Uh-huh.
And I even got to sing in the movie.
Wow.
Because the director said to me, in here we use all your talents. So that was exciting. That was exciting. Another... You know, I've done a lot of stage work,
mm-hmm.
but films seem to be the films, you get a wider audience.
Right.
More people recognize you because it's, films are everywhere.
Yeah.
Internationally. Another film, interesting enough, was McBain.
Mm-hmm.
McBain, I had a choice of two roles to audition for. Mom was a good guy, and the other guy was a bad guy. And I said, you know, since I'm good at doing bad guys, and they're convinced that I am this good at doing bad guys, let me stay with that. And I got the job. I went to the audition, and they... it was a nice monologue where he threatens the president of the president of Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
It was a military man in military clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And I go in there with a henchman and telling the president that he's not going to be in charge anymore. And then he says, you can't talk to me like this. And then my character, Escobar was his name, by the way, he says, you know, the last president said the same thing to me. I still send him flowers. You can't miss it. It's right in the center of the cemetery.
Oh, my God.
And then he looked at me and I said, you're not in charge anymore. And then I left quietly, and he knew that he was not in charge, but I was. So I figured, you know, if I can do these gangsters like this so easily by just playing myself, why not? Right?
Yeah.
On stage, I'm a musical talent. Amazingly enough, I've had like 20 odd years of Man of La Mancha.
That's amazing.
I've done every major Broadway production of Man of La Mancha, of the original version, with the original director, Albert Marr. I've been all over the country.
How did you get that part?
How did I get that part? I got that part because I wasn't sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the newspaper when they were auditioning, it said that they were looking for muleteers, rough men who ride mules. And I read it literally, and I said, I don't think I can fake riding a mule on the stage. So, I mean, they're gonna see right through me when they say, get on that mule and ride it. So I said, well, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to go. And then someone who I knew said, why don't you just take your picture over there and drop it over at the office and tell them Louis Hayden sent you. Louis Hayden used to be the supervisor, wardrobe supervisor of my first Broadway show, The Royal Hunt of the Sun. And he said, go over there. And then so then they said, you know, we're having auditions for the first bus and truck tour. Have you seen the show? And I said, yes. Mm-hmm. Which was not true. I just said yes because I didn't want to say no. I said, so I went and bought a ticket that same night for $5 in the balcony. And I saw the show and I looked and I said, oh, I think I could do that. There's no riding in mule. Nobody's riding a mule here. So the next day I show up for the audition and I sang for them, and unfortunately I was ill-equipped with the kind of singing song, you know, the kind of songs you have to sing. And I sang What a Difference a Day Made, which was the wrong choice, because when you sing for Broadway, you have to sing it with a bigger sound, mm-hmm. a bigger voice, and which I had, but no one told me to do that. So I mm-hmm. just went with what I felt comfortable, and they said, thank you, that's not the voice we're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And then the casting director said, why don't you wait and see if you have jazz, has Jack Cole seen you dance? He was the original choreographer, Jack Cole. I said, no. So Jack Cole, he said, wait a minute. So then me and a few other guys, they put us through the routine of the horse dance,
mm-hmm.
which is what they were looking for. It's a lot of flamenco heel work. With you. It's like tap dancing, but more flamenco-like.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned that, what he taught us, and then he took us individually on the stage with he and I, and he did the horse step, and I did the horse step. He did it, and I did it. So we did it simultaneously to see if I can keep up rhythmically. And of course I did, because, I mean, flamenco is part of my blood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being Hispanic, we know we can fake it.
Nice.
And so then the next thing I know, a few weeks later, they said, we want you to go on the road with us. And that took me off for 7 months. And the rest is history, because then I did every major production.
Amazing.
The last production I did was with Robert Goulet, 1996, I think it was. And I started in 68. So yeah. You can count the numbers.
Oh my God.
And so in between movies, I would do La Mancha.
Oh, okay.
It just happened that I was able to do that. And the director, he liked me so much. Albert Marr, he liked me so much. I never had to audition for him anymore. When he did another Broadway show, Chuchem, which is about the Jewish, it was a Jewish-Chinese musical. And all he did was call me. He says, Hector, are you free? And I said, yes, I'll be, yes.
Oh, my gosh.
And so we did, I played a Chinese Jewish person, a man, who was a prince, the prince's brother. And it was a very important role. I got to sing. I got on the recording of it, too. And I've had a wonderful career. And I'm still doing it. I'm now singing cabaret shows. I do my own cabaret shows. And I have one. I have several.
You must be busy. You must be keeping yourself busy.
I'm still busy. I still take ballet classes. Mm-hmm. I took one Sunday. I'm working with a gentleman working on my tango music, singing. I had a singing teacher, Maurice. He's no longer with us, but he wanted me to be a singer at the Metropolitan Opera because I'm a tenor, so I can hit these high notes easily. You know, to me, high notes are easy to me. And he wanted me to be an opera singer. And I said, Maurice, I can't afford that. You know, you need a sponsor. You need mm-hmm. I would have gone bankrupt. Mm-hmm. So I still sing, mm-hmm. I still dance, and I still take acting classes. And I'm also taking piano lessons.
Just for fun?
Just for fun, because I have a piano at home, and I decided, well, rather than throw it out, I might as well put it to use. So I've been taking piano lessons for the past 2 years. The young lady comes to the apartment, and I'm getting good. I'll never play. I'll never do Carnegie Hall or any of that stuff. Nor am I interested in doing that. But it keeps me busy. Yeah. Keeps me out of trouble. And I still feel like I'm just beginning. Because I'm learning, and everything new I want to learn.
That's great.
What are we doing on time?
We're good. We're about 30 minutes in.
Well.
Is there anything, these are all such good experiences. Do you have
any bad experiences?
Do you have any bad experiences? Or well, less
let
good?
Let me tell you an experience I had in McBain.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are in the jungles of the Philippines. And they, you know, where they say, okay, your job is finished. You and the guy who was my bodyguard, my henchman.
Mm-hmm.
He says, okay, everybody thank them. They thanked us about doing our job, and then our driver decides to take us. It took 3 hours mm-hmm. to get back to Manila.
Okay.
The car breaks down.
In the middle of the forest?
In the middle of the road. We were 2 hours still left.
Oh, no.
Now, in the movie McBain, he and I are escaping in a tank
mm-hmm.
because the peasants are rising up and they're attacking the machetes, and we get caught. So it felt to me like here we are, and the guy, there's no way he can call anyone.
Right.
So we had to hitchhike back to Manila.
No.
And we're hanging onto the back of a pickup truck, and I'm saying, this is how they treat movie actors.
Oh my gosh. So it was just some random stranger that picked you guys up?
Yeah, they said, yeah, we're going that way. I said,
were you scared? I would have been, I don't even
well, know. It's frightening because you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You can get... This is not the USA.
Exactly.
When you're out of the USA, you don't know what can happen.
Oh, my gosh.
And here we are, and the guy that was with me, my henchman,
mm-hmm.
he was a blonde, blue-eyed British guy. And here I am with my features. I could pass for a Filipino.
Okay.
But still...
Oh, my gosh. But you made it, right? It was fine, like no big...
We made it.
Oh, my goodness.
And I've done 3 productions of The King and I.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was when I played the young Prince Chula Longkorn.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was an interesting audition. I, as I said, I've always sung. Mm-hmm. I used to sing doo-wop.
No way.
In the projects where I grew up.
Really?
Yes. With my friends, you know, there were gangs all over the place.
Right.
We decided to become a singing gang. Singing doo-wop.
Oh.
And so, we have history there. I've always sung. And so when it came to the King and I audition, they, I was 27 years old. Huh. And the young prince is supposed to be like 13. But I look so young. I've always
wow.
looked younger than my years. And so I went to the audition. I went to an open call.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, you might be a little too old.
A 27.
Too old. But then I never told them I was 27. I said, well, okay. They said, we'll give you a call back anyway. A week later, I made sure that I looked very, very young and innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in there. And when she started to play the music for the Prince Chula Longkorn song,
mm-hmm.
I realized when she started to hit the first keys that it was going to be too low for my voice. And I was going to sound like a baritone or a bass.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, excuse me. I told her. I said, I really meant to say, can you take it up a few notes higher? But the first thing that flew out of my mouth was an octave. An octave is when you're singing ah, ah.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what I meant. But so the director says, she said, well, it's not written an octave higher. And the director says, go ahead, play it an octave higher. I guess he probably thought I was going to fall flat on my face.
Oh, man.
But since I can hit such high notes,
right.
I hit every single note. And then they said, would you wait a few minutes? And I said, sure. And they started talking among each other. And they said, we'd like you to play Prince Chula Longkorn. So I said, sure, thank you very much. With my young up voice, thank you. Trying to sound very, very young and youthful. When I got to the first rehearsal, the kid who had been at the audition with me, who played young Lewis,
mm-hmm.
is his honest son,
mm-hmm.
Jeffrey, he says to me, you're about 16, right? I didn't have the heart to tell him that I was 27, so I said, yeah, about there.
Oh my God.
No, but that's not all.
Well,
some of the parents...
Mm-hmm.
of the other little girls that play the young princesses
uh-huh.
were trying to set me up on a date with their young 16-year-old daughter, and I go,
oh, no.
I couldn't admit that I was not
right, the
16. So I said, oh, sure, we'll go out. And so I think we went to a diner or something, I can't remember. And I said, oh, yeah, well, Coca-Cola and hamburger. Oh, yes. And I'm playing along with it because I did not have the heart to say,
uh-huh.
you know, I'm really 27.
you might have ruined your part. No one needed to know that.
Well, no, but they thought that I was around 16.
That's crazy.
So, but I wasn't going to, you know,
right.
I wasn't going to go there.
Huh. A full career.
Full career.
Still going.
Full career. Another interesting thing was when I got older, I went to an audition for The King and I
mm-hmm.
in Long Island at Belport Theater.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Gateway. And I sang this song for the Crawler Home.
Mm-hmm.
He's the prime minister, the mean guy in The King and I. And I sang, and they said, oh, very nice. And thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So about... 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later, the show was already going, but they had a change in casting. And then they called my agent and said, they want to know if you could come and do the Crawler Home for a weekend.
Uh-huh.
Now, I had never done the Crawler Home. So I said, sure, tell him I'll do it. I memorized all the lines. You don't have to sing. So I memorized all the lines, and then when I got there, they put me through the blocking with the other actors. Mm-hmm. And I went on for that weekend, playing the Kralahome, never having done it before.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sort of feel like my efforts as a student of acting has paid off.
Right.
Another production of The King and I for the 75th anniversary of the Algonquin Playhouse in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even audition with them. We'll take him. So I went to do that one as well.
How about TV? I think you did some TV.
TV. I did, you know, I did all the soap operas when they were in New York.
Right.
Then they're no longer shooting soap operas. But there was a nice lady called Betty Ray. Betty was with The Guiding Light. She is the casting director.
Mm-hmm.
And I met her, and she liked me, so she had me do a show. And then once in a while, when there was a role open, she says, Hector, how's your French? I go, but of course, my French is very good. She said, okay, you could do this.
Oh, my gosh.
So I did that. I did All My Children a couple of times. I did, you know, always principal roles. I would never do an extra because, you know, there's an old saying in this business, if you start playing extras, that's all they see you for.
Mm.
And so I just refuse to do anything that doesn't have any lines.
Okay.
So I did Search for Tomorrow, you name them. The Guiding Lights, All My Children, One Life to Live.
Huh.
And I've also done some TV movies. One was The Superlative Horse. Oh, that was cute. Superlative Horse takes place in ancient China.
Oh, wow.
But we shot it upstate New York. Huh. Around Warwick. On a horse farm and everything.
Beautiful.
It's very interesting. I played a horse expert. Hong Kong. I played a lot of Asian roles. Only because I look, I don't know, just nondescript. I could play almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
I met a French lady once who said, you are French, right? And then I said, she started to speak to me in French. She was a countess from England. And then I said, no, I'm sorry, I'm not. She said, but your look. I said, well, yeah, but I'm not. So I have that kind of chameleon type of look.
Yeah.
That I could be French, I could be Arabic, I could be Egyptian, I could be Filipino, I could be Spanish. I've done Spanish too. I've been told that I've got that kind of look that I can play anything. The only thing I cannot play, of course, is, you know, neo-Nazis and stuff like that. But now who wants to do that?
Mm-hmm.
So,
but that must have been great. You were cast in so many different types of roles, right?
Yeah. Huh. I played an interesting film as the St. Augustine story. It's now called The Struggle to Survive, mm-hmm. in which I played a Spaniard when St. Augustine was first discovered by Spain. Remember, there was Ponce de Leon
mm-hmm.
who went looking for the Fountain of Youth. But anyway, we were there, and I got cast by that. I played a character named Blas Hernandez.
Hmm.
And we shot it in St. Augustine, Florida. They built a whole new village because what's there now for tourism is not the original.
Oh, wow.
It's what's in St. Augustine's now, in today's day and age, it's a replica.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did, they wanted to be authentic. They built a whole new village for us. And we intermingled with the Indians, the natives. They even gave me a wife as for Blas Hernandez. Very interesting. Very interesting filming. I tell you, I wouldn't change anything for the world. I really enjoyed my career. I started, it's been 50 plus years now, and I wouldn't change a bit of it, really. I could just, I'm still learning. You know, I believe that there's so much more to learn. I don't think I'll ever stop learning.
That's amazing. So, we're going to be wrapping up in a little bit. Is there anything else you'd like to mention?
You mean as far as career, what I've done?
Anything.
Oh. At one point I taught acting.
Oh.
I taught acting in the greater Boston area. There was a school called the Newton High School, mm-hmm. and a few other schools. I came in a program from my union, Actors Equity, and what they wanted to do is they wanted to bring in professional actors into the schools and through acting skills help them with their academics.
Oh, wow.
For instance, I did a scene, I had only girls in this class, it was an all-girls school, so I'm a big buff on Greek mythology.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a thing about Helen of Troy, bringing her on trial, but by other women whose husbands had been killed. So this meant that they had to do research on who Helen of Troy was,
uh-huh.
and who all of the Greek figures there. It meant they had, so in other words, we were helping them with their academics,
mm-hmm.
because they had to then do research.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great experience. It's a great experience. I met a lot of wonderful students there. And would I do it again? I don't know. I don't know. I still take acting classes. You know, as I say, I can always learn something new. And vocally, I'm so happy with what's happening with my voice. I tell you, I wouldn't change anything for the world. I am the most happiest person I know. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we all get depressed, of course, because, you know, when the rejections are really bad.
Yeah.
You know, when you go in and you think you did wonderfully and you don't hear a thing.
Right.
You know, but I always know that it's part of the business and I don't take it to heart.
That's good.
But I don't look at my failures. I look at my
success.
My wins,
mm-hmm.
not my losses.
Yeah.
You know, and my wins are far greater than all the losses I've ever had. Yeah. Because no matter what, 100 years from now, there'll still be a Crocodile Dundee 2 movie.
And I'll still be playing.
And there'll be books and magazines and
pictures and YouTube videos and blog posts.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, thank you for spending this time with me and talking.
Thank you. I didn't know what I was going to say, but you got me talking.
All great stuff. Thank you.
Thank you.